Here's a look at our top stories this hour. U.S. President Joe Biden hails the Nordic nations of Finland and Sweden for their bid to join the NATO military alliance. North Korea reports 260,000 more people with fever symptoms as the country battles its first confirmed outbreak of COVID-19. And China calls for the expansion of a group of emerging economies known as BRICS and the first shakeup of the bloc in over a decade. U.S. President Joe Biden met with the leaders of Finland and Sweden at the White House to offer robust support for their applications to join NATO. In the meeting, Biden said Finland and Sweden would make NATO stronger. He said their accession would enhance the security of the alliance and deepen security cooperation across the board. That says Turkey has threatened to block the Nordic nations from becoming members of the alliance. It's pressed Sweden to halt support for the Kurdish Workers Party, or PKK, it considers as a terrorist group, and lift their bans on some arms sales to Turkey. All 30 NATO members need to approve Stockholm and Helsinki's bid to join the alliance. Sweden and Finland have for decades stood outside the military alliance, but Russia's military operation in Ukraine appears to have heightened their security concerns. Russia says more than 700 Ukrainian fighters have surrendered in the Azovstal steelworks in the past 24 hours, their last holdout in the city of Mariupol. That brings to over 1,700 the number of forces in the plant who have put down their weapons over the past several days after being trapped there for over 2 months. However, Moscow says some 1,000 Ukrainian troops, including top commanders, are still fighting in Mariupol. The city is the biggest Russia has so far captured in the war that began on February the 24th.
Much of Mariupol may lie in ruins, but the city is already coming back to life after months of fierce fighting. A market is open, selling all essential goods, and humanitarian aid is being distributed by organizations associated with the Russian government.
These days the situation is more or less stabilized. People are fed, there are more problems with water, electricity and gas in some parts, and there are still problems with basic domestic needs.
Amongst the ruins, I came across a gathering who are waiting for a drop-off of humanitarian supplies.
During the fighting, I was at home. When there were battles, the house was shaking. I stood with my back to the wall and I was shaking with the wall. When I think of it, I still shiver. There was nothing good about the fighting. We don't want anything except peace and quiet now.
The population of Mariupol before the war was about 450,000. Now, it's hard to estimate, but we think around a third of those people still remain, either stayed during the battle or stayed nearby the city in camps and have now returned. Over the next days, weeks, months, years, we can expect many thousands of people to return here to Mariupol. But who will be those people? Before the conflict began, the city was very mixed between pro-Russian, Russian-speaking people and more Ukrainian nationalist, pro-Ukrainian people. Now that it's under Russian control, as long as it stays under Russian control, we can expect many of the Russian people to come back. But for the Ukrainians, they may well stay away, which means that the ethnic diversity in the city, the ethnic makeup of the city, will change.
It is not yet time to be happy about anything. But there are certain expectations that Russia is a rich country and its politics are more independent. And we hope things will improve.
How do you feel living under Russian rule now rather than Ukrainian?
You see, we cannot say anything yet. We don't understand anything yet. We only want it to be peaceful and quiet. That's what people want here. What else can we say?
Like many people I speak to in areas recently taken over by Russia, she is scared to answer such questions. She may be more pro-Ukrainian, or she might be worried that Russia might not be in control of Mariupol for long. Down by the port area, I found the incongruous sight of fishermen, seemingly oblivious to the fact that war was still raging across the country.
Of course I'm happy. Of course. Truth to tell, we've been waiting for it for a long time. Of course, yes, I'm happy to be under Russian control now, because we have become free. Well, we were free before, but not in this way. The attitude changed. People have a different attitude to each other now. Earlier, we were afraid to say things and speak our minds. Yes, I could get into trouble if I criticized the Ukrainian government.
This is commonly heard amongst Russian speakers here, that they have been marginalized and persecuted by the increasingly nationalist Ukrainian government. This is the reason the East rose up 8 years ago, and why many here welcome the Russians. Unless Ukraine takes back Mariupol, it will now likely be populated predominantly by an ethnic Russian population. Whatever the fate of this city, it will never be the same again. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The Kremlin says the removal of Western sanctions against Russia must be considered in order for Moscow to heed an appeal by the United Nations for access to Ukraine's ports to help ease a global food crisis. Moscow believes the sanctions play a key part in the current food crisis as the bans interfere with normal free trade and target food products. This after the UN Secretary General said he is in contact with various international players in an effort to restore exports of Ukrainian grain and Russian food and fertilizers under the current circumstances. The war in Ukraine and economic sanctions on Russia have pushed up global prices for grains, cooking oils, fuel, and fertilizers. Russia and Ukraine together account for nearly a third of global wheat supplies. Russia's deputy prime minister says half of Gazprom's 54 clients have opened accounts at Gazprom Bank as European companies look for ways to meet payment deadlines without breaking the EU sanctions.
На сьогоднішній день 54 companies, big companies, medium and small ones. As I understand it, about a half of these companies have already opened special accounts in rubles and foreign currency at our designated bank to ensure revenue earnings by converting them into rubles and paying for the gas provided in rubles.
Alexander Novak says certain major companies are ready to pay on schedule. He says the list of gas buyers who paid in rubles will be finalized in the next couple of days. Moscow has called for buyers from nearly 50 unfriendly countries to start paying in rubles. Those countries include all the EU member states, the United States, Japan, Switzerland, and Norway. Russia cut gas supplies to Bulgaria and Poland last month after they refused to pay in rubles. The EU has advised firms against opening a bank account in rubles to pay for gas, but it's not explicitly said doing so would breach the sanctions against Russia. This has put some companies in uncertainty as to whether they can open such accounts to buy Russian gas. Iran's foreign minister has announced the Islamic Republic's readiness to mediate in resolving the Ukraine crisis. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment in a telephone conversation with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. The Russian foreign ministry says the two sides exchange views on international issues, including the situation in Ukraine. Lavrov said Moscow welcomes any initiative to restart negotiations with Kiev. He said Iran plays a constructive role in that regard. Russia and Ukraine have held several rounds of talks since the start of the war in February, but all ended without a breakthrough. The catastrophic collapse of the former Afghan government and national security forces, as well as the subsequent takeover of the country by the Taliban, were direct consequences of decisions made by U.S. presidents. This is according to an official U.S. agency report. Rahmatullah Bokhwan has more from Kabul.
Months after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, confessed that Washington was mainly to blame for the collapse of the former Afghan government and national security and defense forces. The report by SIGAR reveals that Afghan forces' morale were destroyed after then-U.S. President Donald Trump reached a deal with the Taliban in 2020, and President Joe Biden affirmed the U.S. withdrawal in 2021.
In my opinion, the Doha deal paved the way for the U.S.-led foreign forces' withdrawal from Afghanistan. It also gave the Taliban forces the belief that they can take over Afghanistan easily. In fact, the Doha deal and the U.S. withdrawal both were great achievements for the Taliban and Afghanistan.
Former Afghan generals and experts also told the agency that most American support to Afghan forces was stopped or limited, while the Taliban had intensified attacks.
I agree with the Sigar report. The former Afghan Republic government was defeated when the U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban. After the Doha deal, the U.S. stopped its major logistic support, including fuel, rockets, arms, and air support to Afghan forces. It continued until the Afghan army completely ran out of equipment.
Sigar notes that in essence, U.S. and Afghan efforts to cultivate an effective and sustainable security assistance sector were likely to fail from the beginning. Afghan experts also say that the U.S. never meant to build a nation or a state in the country, and all Western-backed armies are doomed to failure.
The former Afghan government was an example of American state-building. They invaded our country, formed their own government, and finally demolished it. They never meant to boost the state-nation process. The Americans appointed their own men to the Afghan government, while they were not representing Afghan people. In addition, the U.S. intentionally established a corrupt and dependent army in Afghanistan.
The Taliban took over Afghanistan in August 2021 as the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan and the former Western-backed government collapsed. Afghans are angry with the U.S. for pushing Afghanistan into a dire situation. People here believe Washington not only betrayed Afghans but also continues to harm them with sanctions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
North Korea reports over 260,000 more cases from fever of unidentified origin, pushing the total to over 2 million. The country's official news agency reported two more deaths, bringing the total fatalities to over 60. So far, North Korea has refused to link the fever cases to the COVID-19 pandemic. However, it confirmed last week that at least one of those who died had been diagnosed with the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has slammed officials for not taking practical measures to timely prevent the outbreak of the virus. Kim has also imposed preventive measures, including restrictions on movement and quarantines. China's president calls for unity among the members of emerging economies known as BRICS to shape global security for all. Xi Jinping urged BRICS countries to enhance political trust and security cooperation to promote peace and development. She made their remarks in a virtual meeting of BRICS foreign ministers. Also speaking at the meeting, China's foreign minister said Beijing aims to expand BRICS. China will be hosting the other BRICS members, Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, for the 14th summit of the organization in late June. New Delhi has ordered shopkeepers in Indian-controlled Kashmir to install CCTV systems at their own expense. Authorities say the move is necessary to protect people's lives. However, activists say the measure legitimizes a complete surveillance of their civic life. Our correspondent, Shahana Butt, reports.
In Indian-controlled Kashmir, a recent order by the authorities is giving sleepless nights to many business owners and shopkeepers. Business owners, big and small, are spending hundreds of dollars each to install security cameras, a mandatory move ordered by the authorities. The official order says the scheme will deter criminals, antisocial and anti-national elements. The order also outlines the minimum standards for camera resolution, infrared capability and range. The government's order has been highly criticized by business owners. They describe the move as a callous approach towards war-weary Kashmir's fractured business establishments, which were deeply dented after India cancelled Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019.
Everybody knows the quantum of the business, it's almost 80% down. It was their duty to install the CC camera. Why to tell to the business you install the CC TV cameras? You see, the 80% of the business company, they cannot afford to install this CCTV camera. So I think they should review this decision and they should look into this.
Muzaffar Jan, a shop owner in the heart of Srinagar's busiest market, Lal Chowk, says it has been days since he has seen a customer at his store. However, to follow the police instructions, he was forced to pull out the money he had saved for running his household.
I waited for around a week to see whether others would install cameras. Later, I was forced because of continuous announcements and strict orders. I installed the camera. It took me around $1,000, and not everyone can afford this cost. In Kashmir, there are frequent power cuts, and to keep the camera plugged in, I had to install an uninterrupted power supply inverter. Many of us can't manage 2 meals a day. How can we afford these cameras?
The order further instructs that the cameras installed at the business owner's expense must always stay on. The system should record and store footage for 30 days and must be produced on demand of police and other law enforcement agencies without any court order. And failure to abide by the order will result in a fine or month-long imprisonment. The level of surveillance in Kashmir is increasing day by day. Authorities argue that the measure will help them protect people's lives. But Kashmiris are calling the move as a worrying development and see it as a threat to their human rights, privacy and dignity. Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Health authorities in some countries in Europe and North America are on alert for the spread of the rare monkeypox viral disease after the emergence of new cases. Portugal reported 5 cases and Spain said nearly 2 dozen cases were being tested. Britain has now detected 7 infections after it announced its first case earlier this month. The United States and Canada have also identified infections. Authorities are working with the World Health Organization to investigate the spread of the virus. Early symptoms of monkeypox include those similar to flu, as well as swelling of the lymph nodes followed by a rash. The first case of monkeypox was reported in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in the 1970s. Well, that's your world news for now. Stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you. Early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
While most of America struggles to put gas in the tank and pay their grocery bills, price gouging, excessive profit-taking CEOs use their captive boards to award themselves record pay, said one expert. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Median Pay of Top CEOs Hits Record $14.7 Million as Workers Strike Over Starvation Wages. Please stay tuned to hear more about the story. As workers across the United States of America attempt to unionize and walk off the job over brutal conditions and starvation wages, an analysis released recently found that the median pay package of top U.S. CEOs jumped to $14.7 million in 2021, the sixth consecutive record-breaking year for executive compensation. According to the Wall Street Journal's review of data from more than 400 U.S. corporations, total CEO compensation rose by at least 12% for most of the executives, and most companies recorded annual shareholder returns of nearly 30%. 9 CEOs made $50 million or more in total compensation in 2021, up from just one in 2016 and seven in 2020. Much of the pay consisted of equity awards that could ultimately prove to be worth more or less than initially reported, the journal noted. In 2020, the median pay package was $13.4 million for the same companies, with median cash compensation of $3.1 million. The journal's analysis showed that Expedia CEO Peter Kern brought in the highest total compensation, $294.57 million, among top CEOs last year. Other CEOs on the list include Warner Brothers, Discovery CEO David Zaslav, $216.6 million, ServiceNow CEO Bill McDermott, $162.23 million, Apple CEO Tim Cook, $82.35 million, and J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, $77.62 million. Rising CEO pay stands in stark contrast to the grim economic realities that ordinary workers are facing nationwide as inflation, driven in large part by corporate profits. Erodes modest wage gains and expiring pandemic aid leaves vulnerable families without a safety net. While most of America struggles to put gas in the tank and pay the grocery bills, price gouging, excessive profit-taking CEOs use their captive boards to award themselves record pay. Jennifer Taub, a professor at Western New England University School of Law and an expert on corporate governance, tweeted in response to the journal's findings. As CEOs rake in huge compensation packages, workers at prominent U.S. companies with ultra-wealthy chief executives, including Amazon, Starbucks, and Apple, are trying to unionize in the face of relentless opposition from management. In recent months, employees at more than 60 Starbucks locations in the U.S. have voted to form a union, winning a remarkable 90% of elections held thus far. Additionally, as labor journalist Michael Santo reported for The Guardian recently, workers in America's fast food and retail sectors who worked on the front lines through the dangers of the COVID-19 pandemic are continuing a trend of strikes and protests over low wages, safety concerns, and sexual harassment issues on the job. My weekly paycheck is no more than $200. $260 at the max. Ashley Sierra, a Dollar General employee who makes $11 an hour, told The Guardian, adding, "I have three children. I cannot survive on $260 a week. It's just not working. It needs to get up to at least $15 an hour. The bottom is $15 because we work so hard for so little." Todd Vases, Dollar General CEO, made $16.45 million in total compensation last year.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners, and let us start the day with a thought-provoking statement from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, regarding violence and oppression. Violence against the servants of Allah is the worst provision for the hereafter.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kazim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إن المرأة إذا نام فإن روح الحيوان باقية في البدن والذي يخرج منه روح العقل.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, when man sleeps, the animal spirit within him remains with his body, and that which leaves it is the rational spirit.
We Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we talk about the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, of course we find that His Eminence spoke about something very unique. He spoke about a conversation and a dialogue that one must have with the Almighty Allah. And so, in a conversation with one of his companions, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam spoke to his companion and told him how one should address the Almighty Allah. Now, of course, when it comes to the Almighty Allah, who better to turn towards when we want to find out how exactly should we address the Creator of all of creation? And so Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam taught this one dua to his companion, and in this dua we find a very beautiful statement. Imam al-Kadhim, addressing the Almighty Allah, says, "You are the object of requests, and to you is the flight." And so, dear friends, in our lives where we really try to find a safe haven to turn towards, and we really try to find somewhere where we can flee and find refuge, here Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam teaches us in this conversation and in this dialogue, in this form of a dua, that it is towards Allah that is the flight. And just as any bird flies towards safe haven and refuge, and ultimately flies towards its home, there where it feels safe, for us, that safe haven and that refuge and that home where we can find complete safety is the Almighty Allah. And also we learn that it is Allah who is the ultimate object of our desires. It is Allah who is the ultimate goal and the ultimate mission and the ultimate purpose of our desires and our yearning. And it is when we put these two things together, the first, that the Almighty Allah is the object of our desires, and two, it is the Almighty Allah to whom we fly towards, will we really begin to understand the beauty that is Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij. This is the door or the gate through which your prayers will be accepted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Your hajat, hawaij, your hajat will be responded to by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala if you take your hajat through this gate. And this is not only limited to the Shias. You know, we have a historian who lived in the 4th century by the name of Al-Khatib al-Baghdadi. And one of his famous books, actually, he's from Baghdad itself, and in his book, Tariq Baghdad, in the very first volume, he talks about the 7th Imam, and he quotes a statement from Abu Ali al-Khilal, a Sunni Hanbali scholar. And this is, you know, before the 4th century. And he says that this Hanbali scholar used to say, "Ma hammani amrun faqasadtu qabra Musa bin Ja'far fatawassaltu bihi." He says, whenever I had issues and problems, I used to go to the grave of Musa bin Ja'far fatawassaltu bihi, and I used to seek tawassul, intercession through him,
إِلَّا وَصَحَّلَ اللَّهُ تَعَالَ لِي مَا أُحِبُّ. And whenever this happened, when I went through him, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala facilitated my hajat and my desires.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
Tehran is hosting the 33rd International Book Fair in person for the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of COVID-19. This has caused enthusiasts to visit the fair for new titles. Saman Kujuri has the story.
The 33rd Tehran International Book Fair is underway in the Iranian capital, with over 1,700 Iranian as well as 170 foreign publishers attending the event. It is the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19 that the Tehran International Book Fair is being held both in person and online. As the top Iranian book event, the fair has millions of visitors every year, including thousands of university students, scholars, and their families.
I'm very happy to see that the book fair has once again opened its doors to the visitors in person after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19. I love reading books. To me, the Tehran Book Fair is my favorite event.
For me, the book fair is an opportunity to get my kids familiar with books. I try to take them to different book fairs so as to teach them that book is a necessity in our life. I want to raise my children with the love for book reading.
A huge number of national visitors, along with international exhibitors from different countries, make this event one of the unique cultural events. The book fair is a good opportunity for publishers to showcase their new products.
We have designed our educational books based on augmented reality, which is an interactive experience of a real-world environment where the objects that reside in the real world are enhanced by computer-generated perceptual information, and students can watch educational films related to any specific topic. It will help students better understand educational topics.
It is said that books give a soul to the universe, wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, and life to everything. And this is exactly what the book fair tries to help you achieve.
By reading books, we feel healthy is the motto of the 33rd edition of the Taiwan International Book Fair, which will be running through May 21st at Imam Khomeini's Masalma. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mondo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make 5 blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I wanted to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay. Cambodian fishermen aiming for small fish were shocked to see the surprise catch tied to their hook. This creature was nothing but an endangered giant freshwater stingray, which had swallowed the fishermen's catch. It was 4 meters long and weighed 180 kilos. The female leviathan is one of the rarest species of fish in Southeast Asia. Therefore, a team of international experts helped unhook the stingray to release it back to the waters unharmed.
All right, so we've just released our giant stingray back into the wild. She's kind of hanging out on the surface of the river here. It's amazing to be able to see her swimming around in her natural habitat and to have participated in the release of this giant stingray today.
The giant stingray was caught in the Mekong River, an important habitat for different species of fish, including huge catfish and barb. However, experts say the river's underwater ecosystem has been damaged by massive plastic wastes. Environmentalists constantly warn that building dams on the Mekong River is also destroying its large fish stock.
Scaling Mount Everest is only a dream for many and a once-in-a-lifetime achievement for most professional mountaineers. Well, not for this Nepali Sherpa, who has now repeated the feat for a record 26th time. 52-year-old Kami Rita led a group of other Sherpa climbers along the traditional Southeast Ridge route to the world's tallest peak. In the process, he beat his own previous record set last year. Rita first scaled Everest in 1994 and has been making the trip nearly every year since then. The Sherpa community
is an ethnic group indigenous to the Himalayan region. They are expert mountain navigators who also carry heavy loads. Everest stands nearly 9,000 meters above sea level. The mountain has been climbed more than 10,000 times since it was first scaled in 1953. The bad news is more than 300 people have died trying. Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. It replaces the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Flush with cash, a PAC appears to be a heavy weight in this year's U.S. midterm elections as it goes after progressives and floods its preferred candidates with millions. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading, As the midterms approach, a PAC throws its weight and money around Washington. Stay tuned for more. Last week, Representative Chantel Brown defeated Nina Turner in an Ohio Democratic primary race for the second time in 9 months. Turner had been endorsed by Progressive Squad member Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and is a vocal critic of the fabricated regime of Israel. Her loss is largely seen as a win for the Israel lobby and specifically the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. In December, AIPAC launched two political action committees, PACs, as a way to be more effective in fulfilling their mission in the current political environment, according to a statement published by the group on social media. In less than 6 months since it was established, AIPAC's PAC has delivered $6 million to hundreds of candidates, becoming the biggest pro-Israel PAC in the United States of America. While its super PAC, the United Democracy Project, UDP, has raised nearly $16 million in contributions. Since AIPAC's PAC operates as a traditional PAC, it can only spend $5,000 per candidate, but its super PAC can spend unlimited amounts of money. AIPAC said in a statement about its fundraising, Our goal is to make America's friendship with Israel so robust, so certain, so broadly based, and so dependable that even the deep divisions of American politics can never imperil that relationship, and the ability of the Jewish state to defend itself, unquote. Flush with cash, AIPAC appears to be a heavy weight in this year's U.S. midterm elections as it goes after progressives and floods its prepared and preferred candidates with millions. AIPAC congratulated Representative Brown on her election victory, writing that it's proud to stand with pro-Israel progressive leaders running against anti-Israel candidates. Endorsed by AIPAC, Brown received significant financial backing from the organization. According to campaign tracker Open Secrets, Brown received $83,171 from AIPAC Super PAC, UDP, and nearly $270,000 from its regular PAC, according to the Federal Election Commission. UDP also spent nearly $200,000 against Brown's opponent, Turner. UDP spokesman Patrick Dorton told Jewish Insider about the PAC's election season plans. "We intend to be active in a significant number of races where there is a clear difference between a candidate who supports a strong U.S.-Israel relationship and a candidate that does not or who may seek to undermine that relationship," unquote. Turner was targeted by the lobby for supporting conditioning aid to the fabricated regime of Israel and standing in solidarity with Palestine on Twitter. AIPAC has also had its hand in several other key races across the United States of America. The group had been actively involved in the Texas race between Jessica Cineros and Representative Henry Culler, as well as Pennsylvania's fight between Representative Summer Lee and Steve Irvin. According to FEC filings, AIPAC has spent over $1 million against Representative Lee and a combined total of more than $600,000 from both its PAC and Super PAC for Irvin. AIPAC's regular PAC must disclose its donor list, but the Super PAC isn't required to reveal contributors' identities. Both PAC's donors are a mix of real estate and finance moguls, but there are some notable contributors. Israeli-American media tycoon Haim Saban contributed the largest amount to UDP, with a donation of $1 million, but he isn't the only company head funneling pro-Israeli campaign contributions. The CEOs of several firms have also donated to the PACs. Ballot Flats brand Tix co-founder and CEO Kefir Gavirelli gave $5,000 to AIPAC's PAC. The founder, CEO, and president of Tasty Brands, David Horowitz, pumped $50,000 into UDP. Jimmy Haber, CEO of BLT Restaurant Group, donated $5,000 to the regular PAC. Fernando Estiu, CEO of Mar Vista Entertainment, which was required by Fox in December, contributed $3,500 to AIPAC's PAC. Grant F. Smith, the director of the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, IRMEP, sees these donor disclosures as an opportunity for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to more strategically target the fabricated regime of Israel's lobby. AIPAC has really exposed itself in the United States and provided a fairly wide open arena for people who don't like their programs to start talking about their donors in ways that have never been possible before, Smith said. Yet with these significant political contributions comes significant political